The Wastewater Information System Tool, TWIST, is a Microsoft Access-based information management system developed for US EPA to help communities inventory and manage decentralized, i.e. individual and clustered, wastewater systems. The webcast will provide an overview of watershed and water quality issues related to wastewater management, discuss treatment system options and management, and address the need for inventory systems such as TWIST. The webcast will also provide an introduction of how to use TWIST and discuss how it can be used to track on-site and clustered sewage systems. Finally, the webcast will also provide information on other tools for small communities and decentralized system users. So let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Barry Towning, is a senior water resource planner specializing in decentralized wastewater treatment, stormwater management, water resources planning, and technology transfer. He has provided support to US EPA's Office of Wastewater Management, Office of Research and Development, and various states and municipalities in developing wastewater and stormwater programs, watershed management programs, and training programs focused on a wide range of water resource management issues. Our second speaker, Dr. Paul, designed and developed TWIST based on US EPA's requirements and input from state and local wastewater officials. He is an environmental engineer with expertise in water resources, watershed modeling, and geographic information systems, with overall 5 years' experience in the water resources field. He has developed many watershed modeling tools for EPA and various state and local agencies. Dr. Paul is currently leading the development of a web-based on-site sewage tracking system for the county, for a county in West Virginia. Our final speaker, Steve Hoagie, is with the Sustainable Communities team in the US EPA's Office of Wastewater Management. He has served as project officer for the Rural Community Assistance Partnership, RCAP, and the Small Flows Clearinghouse. He also helped to develop EPA's voluntary national guidelines for the management of on-site and decentralized wastewater systems and the accompanying implementation handbook. Prior to his employment at US EPA, Mr. Hoagie managed water supply and water quality programs for the Virginia Water Control Board. So now that I have introduced our speakers, let's get started. Barry, take it away.
All right. Thanks, Anne, and welcome everybody to the webcast. If you'll flip your slides over to the second slide, you can see the topics listed there for today's session. We're going to provide you a little bit of orientation on watershed and wastewater management and the need for inventorying small wastewater systems in the watershed. And then Sabu will come on and talk about accessing and using TWIST, and Steve Hoagie will finish up and talk about other US EPA tools for wastewater management. On slide three, you can see a little bit of information on what's impairing some of the waters across the country. This is nationwide data, and you can see there that almost half of the assessed rivers and streams and about half the lake acres and about a third of assessed bay and estuarine square miles are impaired. Runoff pollution, non-point source pollution is mostly to blame. It varies across the country depending on the watershed that you're in. And the chief causes are NPS, nutrients, pathogens, and sediment. On slide number four, you can see a recent document published by EPA in draft form that will be published in final edition here soon, a watershed planning handbook, and you can see the URL down there on the bottom. This was a document produced by EPA with other partners to describe a little bit on how to assess watersheds, determine what the problems are, and develop management strategies for addressing those problems. On slide five, you see the basic watershed planning steps, and we're trying to create some context here for the TWIST system and the septic system and small cluster system issues that we're going to talk about later. These are the basic steps. I think we borrowed our graphic there from Ohio EPA, but these steps are very similar across the country for watershed programs. Build partnerships, assess the watershed, figure out what your goals will be and what management practices are needed, develop the plan, implement, and then adapt and measure progress. Slide six gives you a good graphic you can use in your presentations on where some of the problems are coming from. You can see various point sources and non-point sources there that can impact water quality. Everything from roads and forestry to agricultural operations, wastewater treatment plants, and so forth. On slide 7, you see some of the key pollutants I mentioned earlier and what the details on some of those are. Again, bacteria, nitrogen, and phosphorus, those two nutrients are a big problem in inland freshwaters as well as some coastal waters. And then there are some other contaminants that we're still trying to get a handle on. Pharmaceuticals, cleaners and solvents, some of these are emerging contaminants that are being studied now. We have some information on a few of these, but a lot of research is being done to determine what kind of impact those may be presenting. In terms of sewage treatment, on slide 8, you see a graphic there that tries to graphically present the range of wastewater treatment options. And this is very much a continuum from small individual systems and small clusters through larger systems and finally to large POTWs, publicly owned treatment works. These are the large sewage treatment plants in our major municipalities that people are familiar with. But there are a lot of options for treating wastewater. And on slide 9, you see a little bit of information on centralized treatment plants, very good options for highly populated areas with very dense development, not necessarily a good option when you have less dense housing, rural areas, even in some exurban areas and suburban areas. Sometimes plants are over capacity, they're older. A lot of these plants are being upgraded due to regulations requiring higher treatment levels, and we see the phosphorus limits being implemented nationwide. And in some cases, there can be opposition to expanding plants or siting new plants. So there are other options that can be considered in those cases. Most of the centralized plants discharge to a body of water, a river, lake, stream, or the coastal waters. On slide number 10, you can see some of the options for systems that discharge to the soil. The soil provides a good bit of treatment for these systems. They do, in almost all cases, have a septic tank, whether it's an individual system from a home or small business or a clustered system. For individual systems, you can have a septic tank with a pressure dosing or gravity flow type system. You can also have a treatment facility. And for clustered systems, again, each home will usually have a tank. That septic tank effluent will be collected and routed to a treatment facility either through gravity flow or through a pump type collection system. And there are a lot of options there for the treatment facility. Most of these take the form of either an attached growth or a suspended growth treatment facility followed by the dosed or gravity flow dispersal to the soil. On slide 11, you can see a few photographs of some of these. I know a lot of people on the call here are probably familiar with some of these. A lot of these attached growth and suspended growth systems are encapsulated in a tank, and you can see one of the proprietary systems there on the top left, and opening the hatch, you see some of the foam cubes. The wastewater effluent from the tank is sprayed through that pipe you see on top over those foam cubes, trickles down. The organisms that treat the sewage attach to those cubes and grab nutrients and other pollutants out of the wastewater as it trickles down, and that is how the treatment process occurs, very much similar to the process in a large trickling filter plant at a major sewage treatment operation. Lower left, you see another of these attached growth type filters. This one has some plastic panels that provide the surfaces for the organisms to attach to. And on the lower right, you see one of the more popular options today for dispersing the treated effluent from those wastewater facilities to the soil. In this case, you see some pressurized drip lines. This is a technology that came from the orchard industry. And here you see some of the drip lines being applied to some scarified soil and some imported soil being brought in to ensure the proper separation distance to groundwater or bedrock. On slide 12, you can see a couple of different subdivisions. There's a great deal of interest now in decentralized wastewater treatment because of some of the limitations of centralized plants in terms of cost to run collection lines or other issues. and decentralized wastewater treatment has been embraced by low-impact development approaches. And you can see there the two different types of developments, the conservation development where the houses are tightly clustered and a minimal amount of disturbance on the site in developing that subdivision, versus the site on the right where most of the vegetation is clear, the houses are scattered farther, the roads are wider, the driveways are longer. Decentralized clustered systems work very well with low-impact development, and there's a good deal of information on that available. On slide 13, you see one of the documents that have come out providing a really good economic analysis of centralized and decentralized wastewater treatment. We're not going to get into this report. It's fairly lengthy, but you can see the URL down there, the title and the cover. And for those of you who are interested in looking at some of the economic issues associated with different types of wastewater treatment along the continuum, I highly recommend this study. Slide 14, let's focus in a little bit more on individual wastewater treatment systems. In a lot of cases, when these systems are inspected, we find that they do work very well if they're designed, installed, planned, operated, and maintained properly. This is an example of some inspection results from an area in South Carolina, and you can see there that we have most of the systems are working fairly well. We do find some systems that have malfunctioned for various reasons when these inspection studies are done. On slide number 15, you can see what some of the issues are in conducting watershed studies of small wastewater treatment systems. You can have localized impacts that are very significant from individual septic systems or clustered systems, and we see these significant localized impact in studies around lakes, for example, coastal waters, or areas where you have a lot of septic systems in a very small area on very small lots with relatively poor conditions for the typical gravity flow septic tank infiltration system units. But in many cases, when you start to examine things on a larger landscape type scale, the septic system impacts will get washed out to a certain extent by other factors. And you can see in the pie charts there from the Chesapeake Bay, you may have very significant localized impacts from septic systems on certain places around the bay, but as you start looking bay-wide, the impact starts to go down, and we see this as fairly typical across the country. Just a couple of other slides before we get into TWIST. There are some tools, if you're doing watershed studies, to look at septic system impacts. You see the URL there on slide number 16 for the STEP-L spreadsheet model, the spreadsheet tool for estimating pollutant load. This is acronym day here on the webcast. And this is a freely available spreadsheet tool that can be used to develop watershed management plans. On the next slide, 17, you can see one of the screens. And basically, you select an area that you're interested in. You can do it. You can select state and county, or you can select a HUC, a hydrologic unit code, a watershed basin. And the model has some data that's preloaded, and then you can access that and start to generate information about various sources of sediment, nutrients, and pathogens in those drainage areas. On slide number 18, you'll see another model that was developed by Penn State University. This is based on an ArcView version of the GWLF model, and it's called PREDICT. They're using this model statewide in Pennsylvania now to develop watershed management plans. It looks like a very useful tool. You can see the URL on the right-hand side of slide 18. And on slide 19, you see one of the screens that's generated as you load in acreages for various types of land uses like row crops, pasture, high-intensity urban, and so forth. And as you look down the left-hand side there on slide number 19, you can see the septic system entry there. You can put the information in there on number of septic systems and the land area that you're looking at, and it will start to generate for you, using the default values in the model, the estimated loadings for total nitrogen, total phosphorus, and you can also start to put management information in there on upgrading those systems or clustering them together and start to generate estimates of future loadings from nitrogen and phosphorus. So I just wanted to present a couple of useful tools for people out there that are working on watershed management plans and do have septic systems as one of the issues that they're dealing with. On slide 20, a quick summary of some key management issues for managing existing systems and new systems. In terms of existing systems, inventories are really needed. Usually planners will do an inventory and an inspection of existing systems to determine impacts on surface and groundwater. They'll assess those systems and the risks they pose and find and fix obvious problems. In terms of new system management, where people are trying to get ahead of the curve and prevent future impacts from either individual on-site or cluster system, planning and design criteria are key, as well as managing construction and assuring operation and maintenance of these systems. Inventories are a big part of that. On slide 21, you see results of a study that, again, I think this is also from South Carolina. A lot of programs have depended on homeowners to provide the operation and maintenance attention needed for their individual home septic systems. But when you poll people out there that actually own these systems, you'll see results like this. The question, do you think most homeowners with septic systems are knowledgeable about septic system operation and maintenance? And in this case, a third strongly disagree, a little over a third somewhat disagree, and only about, 18% strongly or somewhat agree that homeowners know enough about these systems to provide operation and maintenance. And this result has been confirmed by a number of studies that have been done on homeowners and whether or not they actually know what to do to maintain their systems and then whether or not they actually do it. Slide 22 presents the keystones of management. Management intensity for small and medium-sized wastewater systems is tied to risk. And the key risk factors to consider are the sensitivity of the receiving water, whether it's the surface water or groundwater, the local setting, things like slopes, soils, climate, and so forth, and the complexity of the systems. Are they gravity flow? Do they have float switches and pumps? And then the density, how many systems per acre. Another key point in management is that some type of management entity is needed. And we have lots of examples of these across the country. EPA, the Office of Wastewater Management, will soon be releasing a series of case studies on septic system management. And we have examples where sanitation districts have managed systems. Systems have been managed under mandatory maintenance contracts, which is getting to be fairly typical now in the states when you have systems with electrical or mechanical components. Some have renewable operating permits, and in some cases you have third parties, either a public or private party, that will actually own and operate the systems. It is important, regardless of the management entity developed, that there is some sort of public agency oversight over the systems to ensure that this community function is being overseen properly. EPA resources on the web, you can see some listed here. They're all available at the URL on the top of slide 23 and covers of some of these documents. Steve Hoge will talk a little bit more about these here in a few minutes. The EPA's on-site and clustered system management handbook, which has a graphic pictured on slide 24, has some information on developing a management program for individual or clustered wastewater systems. And you can see the first two steps here on this slide: conduct initial scoping and outreach and convene people to start to look at your project and set some goals. On slide 25, step three there, you can see highlighted in red where this inventory piece comes in. This really is a cornerstone for developing a management program where you have existing systems. A lot of states now are developing ways to inventory existing systems. In a lot of cases, though, if you go back 10 years or so, that information is not available. TWIST was developed to provide a way for small counties or small health departments to have a freely accessible tool for entering their inventory information, and Sabu is going to get into that in detail here in just a minute. So that's the conclusion of our orientation piece here. We're going to pause here just for a minute and see what kind of questions we have. I see our questionnaire staff furiously taking notes here, so we'll see what we've got.
Thank you, Barry. We are going to pause here briefly to take some questions, and we're going to begin with those that are submitted online. And just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. And so I'm going to have a couple questions here for Barry, but I just wanted to make a little point here. Some of you might wonder why the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds is sponsoring this webcast. Isn't this more of a wastewater management thing? And actually, we work very closely with our Office of Wastewater Management, and OWL actually did have leadership and funding, I think, to develop this TWIST tool. These things all work together, particularly when you have septic systems or decentralized wastewater systems, that if they're not managed correctly, they can become a big water quality problem, can interfere with some of the goals, watershed management goals that we work on in OWL and also in the wastewater management program. So with that, I have a couple of questions here for Barry. I think he can answer. We also have several other experts here on decentralized wastewater systems in our room here, if the questions come up that are appropriate for them. Barry, the first question, how often does an operator have to change out the attached growth media in a decentralized system?
Now, that's a good question, and that's going to vary. I hate to be a little bit evasive here, but that's going to vary quite a bit depending on the wastewater flow and strength. The organisms that are in the sewage naturally will colonize the attached media, and that attached growth media can be just about anything from gravel, stone, sand. They've used tire chips in some cases. You saw the foam cubes and the plastic panels. The wastewater strength and flow will determine what kind of colonization rates you get on the attached media and when that media needs to be cleaned. It will vary quite a bit depending on the flow and the strength for that system. And this is, again, why systems need to be managed. An electromechanical system may need to be inspected monthly. It might need to be inspected every 6 months. But there does need to be an inspection schedule for these types of electrical and mechanical systems to look at that very issue. Is the media in need of attention now? Does it need to be changed? Does it need to be serviced? Are the flow switches working? Is the effluent filter in the tank clogged up? So it is going to be very much based on usage.
Okay, thanks, Barry. Another question. You mentioned dosing. What does that mean, dosing?
Dosing? Gravity flow septic systems, which I think everyone is familiar with, are based usually on a septic tank and a drain field of some sort. And the wastewater flows out of the building through gravity, through a pipe that has a slope to it into the tank. And then as more wastewater comes into the tank, wastewater from the septic tank flows out into the drain field. And in most of the conventional type system, this all occurs through gravity with additional wastewater inputs into the tank. With a dosing system, after the septic tank, you'll have a pump tank, and you can dose the wastewater from the tank directly to a drain field, either based on time or based on volume. The efficacy of soil treatment is improved significantly by dosing the wastewater at regular intervals to the soil media. If you can take that effluent either from the tank or from the treatment unit, if you have an attached growth or suspended growth type treatment facility, and that wastewater then flows into a pump tank, and you dose that every 15 minutes, for example, or every 30 minutes, so many gallons, and do that all day and all night long, that provides a consistent flow of wastewater to the soil system. It prevents oversaturation of the soil media during certain times when water use in the house is heavy. Another advantage of dosing, too, is in the recirculating type filters, attached filters, in many cases sand or gravel, where you can recirculate some of the effluent that comes through the trickling filter back to the septic tank. And when you take that aerated effluent from the trickling filter and route it back to the tank, you put that high nitrate wastewater into a low oxygen environment where you get denitrification and you can significantly reduce your nitrogen concentrations in your wastewater before you apply it to the soil. The soil media does not provide very much additional treatment of nitrate. Nitrate is fairly stable, very soluble, and will flow with the wastewater. So recirculation and dosing can give you a way to knock that nitrate level down a little bit more.
Okay, thank you. Another question. Are there other tracking databases available?
Yes, there are several tracking databases available. There are a number of manufacturers of these. I think we may have some of these listed on the EPA's website. You saw the URL earlier. I hate to mention any by name because I'll probably leave some out, but if you do a search on management information system, septic system, you'll see a number of these. And if anyone wants to email me, I think my email address is available. I'll be glad to send you some information on these.
Thank you, Barry. At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, I ask you to please unmute yourself and give your name and organization before you ask your question. Any questions?
Yeah, hi. This is Anish with the Virginia Department of Health.
Momentarily. Please.
Hello?
Stay on the line.
Hello?
I'll put better music on here.
Yeah.
I'm going to put you on hold. Okay.
Your call is important to us.
Okay. Unfortunately, I've had to mute the phones again. We're not going to be able to take questions from the phone lines. I do have one more question here for Barry that I want to ask. How come there are no phosphorus impacts in Chesapeake Bay system on the slide 15?
There are phosphorus impacts from individual septic systems on the Chesapeake Bay, but when you pull back and you look at the entire bay watershed, it's so large and there are so many other sources of phosphorus in the Chesapeake Bay area that the contribution from septic systems becomes very tiny. As I mentioned, on some of the coastlines on the bay, you can have significant impacts from septic systems, but they're usually very localized. EPA has a Chesapeake Bay program. They have a webpage with quite a few studies on there. The state of Maryland, and I think there's also a Chesapeake Bay Foundation webpage that has a lot of information on that. And I would encourage folks to look on those webpages for some of that information on assessment for the bay. Also, one last thing I want to add to my previous comments about dosing. The drip irrigation lines that you saw in one of the slides, one of the advantages of applying that wastewater through these drip irrigation lines is these lines are installed with a vibratory plow very near the surface, about 6 to 10 inches down, and you're in the upper soil horizon at that level, and you're applying that effluent from your septic tank or from your treatment facility very high in the soil profile, where you have a good carbon source for denitrification. You also have an opportunity for some evapotranspiration of the wastewater and also for some nutrient uptake by plants. That is one of the reasons that the drip irrigation systems for applying treated effluent to the soil have become real popular.
Thanks, Barry. We have one more question. I understand it was the question that the gentleman was trying to ask verbally on the phone lines. I'm going to ask you to please mute your phones, and particularly if you're streaming music, so for our next question and answer session, we'll be able to open the phone lines. Barry, the question that we have here was, when was the South Carolina study referenced in slide 14 and 21? When was that done? Who did that study?
Those slides came from the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control, DHEC. And if you look up Foley Beach on their website, you'll see those PDF files of those slides. I should have given South Carolina credit for those, but there was a project done down at Foley Beach, and they looked at quite a few systems and attitudes and knowledge and so forth. That's the source of those slides.
Okay, I have one more question that for Barry. What are the advantages and disadvantages associated with various methods for ensuring the system is operated and maintained? And what is the best way to ensure a stream of continuous funding? This is from Shannon in Missoula, Montana.
Oh, that's a great question. And a lot of folks across the country have been working with their states and EPA on developing management programs for individual and clustered systems. And we're talking about everything from individual gravity flow systems that were installed 40 or 50 years ago to high-tech cluster systems for the newest subdivisions. For new development, the funding stream usually comes from user fees that are charged to the people generating the wastewater in the very same manner that centralized sewage treatment plants are funded. So for new wastewater systems, it's usually set up as either a public or private utility. The money for installing the system components often is paid for when the development is constructed, usually in many cases by the developers themselves or by the wastewater utility, and that capital cost is covered and O&M is covered by user fees. In terms of existing systems, there's are quite a few options here too. In the EPA case studies document that I mentioned will be coming out soon, you'll see some examples where a user fee system has been established. You'll also see some examples where sanitation districts or other types of special districts have gotten funding either through their county or through their state or other means to do the inspections and so forth. And usually in these cases, what you're seeing is a kind of a triage approach to identifying the worst systems with the most problems, dealing with those, finding the ones that need to be monitored, and inspecting them all based on the type of risk they pose and the type of technology, whether it's gravity flow or electrical and mechanical.
Okay, thank you, Barry. At this time, we're going to move on to our next session. Sabu Paul, take it away.
Thanks, and the second part of the presentation, I'll be talking about the technical aspects of the TWIST tool. By the way, my name is Sabu Paul. I work for Teratech. On the slide 28, this shows the general flow of the presentation. It starts with an overview of the TWIST application, and then we talk about the workflow of the data entry and show some, next we talk about some functionality, some detailed functionality of the system. And lastly, the system implementation and some of the, some guidelines or some instructions how to use it and maybe customize it. On this slide, you can also see the cover page of the TWIST user's guide, and this can be, the user guide can be downloaded from the EPA website where the system is also available. I'll be talking about the site later, so I'll give the URL at that point. On slide 29, the system is designed with the database concept of actually applying the real-world scenario for a treatment system, where this shows that treatment system you are mostly installing in some of the property, and it's going to serve one or more facilities. The facility can be either on the same property or site, or it can be in another site also. And when you install a treatment system, you usually have to have continuous maintenance or periodic maintenance and service. And one thing I forgot to mention, before we install a system, you usually conduct a site inspection for the property or site where you are going to install the treatment system. And treatment system sometimes can have complaints. So this database tool is designed to capture all these elements. Slide 30, Anne already mentioned that TWIST is developed using Microsoft Access Database with the guidance of EPA to help local, county, and state health departments to track and manage the on-site and clustered wastewater treatment system. I may be using the term septics in between, so it means the same on-site and clustered wastewater treatment systems. And this is an adaptable tool. The idea is to have all the necessary elements in the beginning, and if somebody wants to customize the tool for their general need, then you can easily customize it. This is an asset management system or an inventory tool where the user can enter new data, they can update or view existing data, and also it provides some, currently it provides a sample report, but at the same time you can customize it to your whatever need. You can create more reports and it can be easily done. Slide 31 shows the general data entry workflow. The data entry workflow is designed thinking about a three-tier concept where actually the database, the core of the database is treatment system information, but almost all the data elements are tied to the site. So in order to enter any information like permit or treatment system or site evaluation information, you need to first enter the related site information in the database. Without that, you won't be able to enter any of the second-tier information. And similarly, third-tier information like service report and the facility information can only be entered once you have the related treatment system in the database. You can notice that the compliance, even though it's part of the tier three, it has a dashed line between the treatment system and compliance. This means that actually the compliance can be entered without having the related treatment system in the database, but at the same time it is actually dependent on the treatment system. The reason we designed this way because sometimes the people who are entering the complaint may not wait till you have the treatment system in the information, so in the database. Slide 32, it is an extension of the data entry workflow. It basically shows in the main form of the application, you can see that different controls to enter new site and permit information, new complaint, new service information, and also you can update or look up an existing data and also provide a sample report. The way it works, when you click on the new site and permit information, it takes you to the site information. And once you enter the site information and save that record, then you will be able to enter the related permit and site evaluation and treatment system. And once you have the treatment system in place, then you can enter the related or corresponding service reports and facility information. And also, whenever you are updating or looking up the existing data, at the same time also you come to the site information, find the site you want to look up or update. Then if you want to update the related information, then go from there. So the workflow is pretty much the standard. Slide 33 shows some general navigational controls in all the forms. This is pretty much the standard look and feel in terms of the controls in all the forms. There is a set of four controls in the bottom of the form or all the forms, which is to navigate between the records. The first one is the going to the previous record. If you're in the current record, you can move back to the previous record, and then the second one is the next record, and save record and add new records. And on the right-hand side, and there are a set of controls, but the common controls in all the forms are the help and the return to main form. And this middle one, the permit information, site evaluation, and treatment system, it is dependent on the current form. If you are in the site general site information, you have the related controls on that. If you move to another form, that will be changed.
I just want to interject right here. For those of you who have downloaded Twist or who will be doing so shortly after the call, that button there on the right, return to main form, that will be on every form that you see. And that is the way you get back to the beginning. So be sure to look for that button there. And as Sabu mentioned also, I want to reiterate the help button. That pulls up the PDF document that has all the information about downloading and using Twist. So those two there are key things to remember as you go through the various forms.
Thanks, Barry. And, slide 34. There is another common thing with most of the forms. It's not all of the forms, but most of the forms have a tabbed form approach or tabbed format. The idea is to group related information into one tab so that people can easily find where you want to enter the data. For example, at the same time, this this represents one single record in the database. So whether you are in a second tab or third tab, it doesn't matter, but it's going to basically record one information. Like, so the idea is whenever you are saving record, it's going to save all the information from all the different tabs in that form. It's not, you are not saving on an individual tab. For example, here you can see the two tabs for the general site information. And the slide 35, I'm going to now talk about the functionality or the detailed functionality of some of the data elements. And the first one is the general site information. It has two tabs. The first one is the ownership tab, which actually records the ownership in terms of property ownership and the system ownership. I would like to mention some of the common controls here too. If you notice that some of the controls have a down arrow button, that actually means that is a list you can pick from, and this can appear in any form. So whenever you see a down arrow button, that means you can pick an existing list, pick from an existing list. Also, one thing you can notice on the top, in this one, there is a select name to autofill address. That is available in all the places where it is an address or personal information is needed. The idea is once you enter one person's information, you can use or reuse that information in all other places. So, for example, if you have one single person has an ownership of many different facilities or many different sites, then you need to enter that address only once, and then you can pick that name in all other different places.
You'll see as Sabu goes through the forms here that we did include a lot of data fields. One of the goals of TWIST was to identify all of the key data fields that a health department or other management entity might need to do system inventories and also to collect information on the site, the facility being served, and the people involved. And we saw a lot of different options. Sometimes you had a person that owned a lot of rental property, and so you would have a bunch of systems at several different addresses, and they would all have the same owner. So you'll see in these forms we tried to include as much information as we could for some of the various situations that you'll run across out there in the field.
And one more thing in this form, like if you look at the system owner details, there is a checkbox to say same as property ownership, property owner. That means if you want to use the same person for as the property owner and the system owner, you don't need to enter the information twice. You just click on that checkbox, and it will be auto-filled with the other information. And, okay, slide 36. This shows the property information tab for the general site. It pretty much has the information about the property, the location, and what type of place, and also some geographical coordinates information. You can enter these. And, for example, in this case, you can see that place type you can select from the list of available places like village, town, or city, things like that. And the geographical coordinates you can enter as the decimal, or when you click on that data entry control, you basically get another form where you can enter the enter in degree, minutes, and seconds. Slide 37 shows the permit details of about the permit information, which basically has the general information and general information like permit types and when the permit was issued, and also if there is any special permit condition applies for that permit. Notice the controls on the right side. You can only see help back to site. That means there is no other related form for this permit details or permit information form. So you can go back to the original site when you click the back to site. I'm not going to show the screenshots of permittee and the maintenance because those two controls only have the address, or permittee contains the permittee or the person's address and the information, and maintenance contains the maintenance contractor's information, and that's
this is one of a couple of pages here where you have multiple tabs at the top, and I think everybody is probably somewhat familiar with this approach. where you, as Sabu said, where you have a large body of information and you can break that down into different categories. And here you see several tabs across the top, and Sabu is going to show you a couple of those here on the next few screens.
And one other information is when in the permittee and the maintenance permittee information page, it's actually it's looking for an address and a person information. By default, it will be filled with the property owner, and if you need to change, you can change or you can keep it as such. Slide number 38 shows the operating permit details. It's basically, again, the name of the person who is operating and the detail of the person who is operating and then what kind of operating permit and things like what is the frequency of pumping out or inspection, and those kind of details are stored in this operating permit tab. And the last one, probably one of the important one is the permit violation details tab. It records the permit violation, type of violation, and when it happened, and if it was brought back to compliance on that date, and what type of action taken. And one important thing with this tab is you can have multiple permit violations for the same permit. So you can actually store, you can enter one permit violation and then go to add a new record in the same form itself. It's kind of many one-to-many relationship between the permit and the permit violations. Slide number 40 shows the general information about the treatment system. This contains some system details like number of the structures within the system and system details like when it was installed. Also, it contains the detail about the installer and who is the manager of the system. Some other tabs, I will be talking about most of these tabs, except the infiltration setback. It is basically the distance between the treatment system and to the nearest receiving water body or the property boundary. And also you can notice on the right-hand side, the controls are completely different from the previous ones. You can go to the service report from that treatment system, or you can look or enter the facility served by this treatment system. Slide number 41 shows the information about different types of tanks and the waste flow information. You have the design flow and the waste strength for the waste flow information. And you could have up to two types of grease trap tank and also up to three tanks of septic or three septic tanks. And it stores information like size of the tank and the material type mainly. By the way, all these forms, as Barry mentioned earlier, we are trying to capture all the data elements, but it doesn't mean that you have to always enter all these elements. You can leave, if you don't have information about any of the fields, you can leave them blank and it still work fine. There is no problem. It won't give you an error. Like some of the fields are essential, but some other fields you can just leave it blank. Next slide number 42 shows the treatment details, like what type of post tank treatment you want to use. There is already a pick list available, so you can select from that list, and you can select the distribution system type or the flow type. And the slide number 43 shows the equipment details. It's under the electrical and mechanical features. It's mostly what type of equipment you have in the treatment system, whether you have a pump or if you have, then how many number of pumps, if you have a timer. All these fields with the question mark means it's basically yes or no. You can just pick the answer from the list. Slide number 44. This is one of the forms which has no tabs. It's just one single form. It is the facility information. It's basically you enter the facility address, and details like facility types and what type of facility and what are the number of bedrooms, bathrooms, and what are the facility area, and what is the water supply source.
So this data form here is where we're trying to capture information about whether this is a house, whether it's a gas station with a small restaurant. You can see the drop-down menu down arrow there and the upper third of the screen, facility type. And this is our way of trying to capture what type of facility might be served and some details about it, whether it has hot tubs, water softeners, rental property, where it gets its water from, and so forth.
Slide number 45 is another single form. It's a site evaluation information where you put the site description and details like what is the landscape and what type of soil analysis you have done and what type of results you got. The landscape type is whether you have a steep slope or the medium slope, and then where is the landscape position, whether you're on top of the slope or in the, like that information. And also soil analysis type, you can pick the type of analysis you are doing from the list, and then you can pick the result. Many of these, pick list, you may have an option like other, then you can pick that other and then specify in the next control. For example, in this case, you have the soil analysis type. Whatever type you are looking for, you can find, then you can put it, and then you can specify in the next control. Slide number 46 shows the general information about the service reports. It shows the who is providing the service for the treatment system, basically the address and that kind of information, and whether if you have a licensed person, then you can enter the registration or the license number. And the inspection info provides like some details about what type of inspection you are doing, whether you needed a repair for the system, whether the system is in compliance, and if you have received any complaint, and if you're inspecting based on the complaint, then you can enter that information. Other two tabs, components info and repair info, basically tells you what type of components you are inspecting and also what type of components you are repairing, whether if you require a repairment then, or if you've done a repairment, then you can enter in those tabs. Next one, slide number 48, captures the complaint. It's basically you can enter the address of the treatment system or location of the treatment system, and then you can pick the type of complaint, and then if you want to have a narrative description, then you can put the complaint description in those fields. Slide 49 shows a sample report. This is just to show a sample of report you can generate from the system, but at the same time, most of the time, the reports are very, very much needed to be customized for individual users, so they can design their own reports and just want to show a sample so that you can get an idea of what you can do with the report. Slide 50, it shows the implementation of the system. We actually try to separate the data and the user interface or the front end. The way it is, like there are two files, one file called twist_data.mtb, that is the back-end database where you actually store all the data elements. But the twist.mtb is the front end where you have all the user interface. And if you go to slide 51, you can see the very first time when you start using it, you need to link them together so that, because this file system or this information is very computer specific, wherever you are putting it's a hard coded path. So first time when you install it, you need to link them together using the tool available in Access. It is called Linked Data Manager. All this information is pretty much, it's not in the user. This part is not in the user guide. So if you have any problem using it, then you can either contact us or search for Linked Table Manager in Access. There is a user, slide number 52, there is a user authentication form. When you open the system the first time or anytime afterwards, you can see that you need to log into the system to use it. But at the first time, you may not have an user ID within the database. It's actually stored in the database itself. So you need to register your name with the next slide.
Let me just interject here that when you download the Twist database file from the website, or you open up the file on a CD. I know some people have accessed it using a CD. Especially on the CD file, when you open it up, you'll be looking at a Microsoft Access file that is read-only. And if you want to use this, if you want to be able to register, you do need to save that file to your machine so that it's not just a read-only file. It's like other read-only files. It won't let you change the file itself. So if you, I'm not sure about downloading it from the web, but I do know if you're downloading it from the EPA disk, you need to save that file to your computer and then open it, and then you can, as Sabu mentioned here just now, you can register, and I think that's the next page he's going to cover.
The next slide is slide number 53. It shows the registration form where you just put some simple information like name and office name, and then you can create your own user and password. Actually, the idea of having this user authentication is in future if you want to have a real, like, sense of, like, you want to know who is doing what type of data entry and who is updating, those kind of information we can actually easily do with this user authentication. Slide number 54. As I mentioned earlier, like, this is a can be considered as a template with most of the elements or almost all the elements you need for a decentralized wastewater treatment system inventory. But at the same time, many of you may not really need all this data entry, and you don't want to have the same forms. You want to redesign some of those, or you want to redesign the data structure. It's easy to do it. The user guide provides some of the guidelines how to do customization, and it's mentioned in the user guide section 4. It also provides some information if you want to make it like a secure, real secure database. Last slide, 55, it shows where you can get the Twist database system. It's on the EPA website. Its link is provided in this slide. And it also can be available, I mean, you can also get it from on a CD from EPA. The information how to get it, it's already provided in the website. You can also download the user guide individually on a, as a PDF format. One thing I would like to mention before finishing this, this is an Access database which is meant to be like a personal database where you can store, if one person can use it, you can do anything with that. But if you are in a multi-user environment, probably this is not the best. There are different options to use it, even with this one, but it's not like a very multi-user friendly database. So that probably need to keep in mind.
Yeah, as Sabu mentioned, this database was developed for kind of a small application, maybe a health department office or a small county. But as you mentioned, if you are moving into a system where you're going to have multiple users in different offices across a geographic area, there are a lot of other options for that. Sabu mentioned that Twist can be adapted using a other type of database system where you have a web page interface and your users can access the web page, enter their username and password, and then access a more dynamic type of web database. Twist was developed to identify the data fields to provide a free system that small counties or counties with few resources could use. Twist is also available for adaptation. If someone wants to take Twist and, as Sabu said, eliminate some of the data fields and change the forms around, there's no problem with doing that. It is out there for free use. It currently is no EPA support for Twist, so people are free to use Twist, adapt it as needed. Microsoft Access is a fairly common format for these types of databases, and there are people out there in the counties and cities and states that are very familiar with Access and adapting it for use for their own, more amenable to their own personal situations in their counties and so forth. So it really is out there for people to use and change and adapt as they want. And I think now it's time for questions for Sabu.
Thanks, Sabu and Barry. We have a number of questions at this point, and we are going to briefly pause. First of all, we're going to take the questions that have been submitted online. I am going to remind you that you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark at the bottom of the page. We are going to take quite a few questions because I think that's where some of the nuances and subtleties of this program will come out, just by having a little bit of dialogue back and forth. So first of all, Sabu, the first question, is there validation to verify that the same location and address cannot go into the system more than one time? This is a question from Douglas in Trenton, New Jersey.
Actually, it's a good question. I would say right now there is no validation for that location, whether you repeat the same location. There are validations for some other fields, like if it's the same person, and it will check if you are trying to enter the same person, then it will ask, like, you want to select the existing person instead of entering it again. But for the location, right now it is not there. Actually, it is, I mean, if you're familiar with Access, you probably can do it very quickly. I mean, it's just one single query you can add to the database. When you enter it, just check it whether you have it in that table. But if you are in that similar situation, you don't know how to do it, you can contact me and then I can help.
Okay, thank you. It sounds like it's a relatively quick fix. So, another question for you. Is there a way to attach a schematic or plan drawing to these records in the database? This is a question from Denise in Boisman, Montana.
The current database does not have it, but it's easy to do it, and it's very easy to do it. You can add that field. It's basically an object field, and you can add it to one of the tables, and then you can do it. But remember, if you are doing that way, Access is not very friendly with a huge database. If you are going to upload a lot of images into the system, that's going to fill up the space very quickly. Another easy way to do it is you can put it on the hard disk itself and then probably just directly link it to that instead of uploading that system. Because I have experience with the same septic system database in one of the counties, they had this. Ultimately, it reached that limit 2 gig, and it was not even opening. So it's not the best thing if you have a lot of systems.
Okay, thank you, Sabu. Another question for you, and we may have to open this up to others to also chime in. The question is, what is the name of any county health department or state health department that has been using TWIST? What kind of feedback have you gotten on the system? This is a question from Mike in Indianapolis, Indiana.
We have not been tracking that at all. We developed TWIST about 2.5 years ago, and we made it available first through CDs and now on the website. And this was a very small project that was funded by EPA, Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds, and coordinated with the Office of Wastewater Management, and there just simply was not funding to do very much after that. So we worked with some state and local folks, developed it, tested it internally, and then put it out there. We do know that we have heard that there are requests that come in for the CDs before it was put on the website when we would have workshops and we would mention it. It would be a spurt of requests from the EPA warehouse for the disk, and it was eventually put on the website, but we have not been tracking that, so we just don't know. Sabu may have something to add to that.
Actually, I don't remember the actual county names, but I have been contacted a few people. I mean, like a few county people were using it, and one or two in Maryland, county people contacted me, and I helped them set up the system. And I also conducted a training in New Jersey. It's organized by the New Jersey DEP, and it was for different county people. And another thing could be we could search in one of the listservs to find whether there is any other people using the system.
And also we know that when the system was first available on disk, that we ran out of disk after a few months, and they had to burn another group of CDs to send out. So we do know there were quite a few requested early on.
Okay, well, thank you. It sounds like there's a lot of interest in this, and also the fact that we have a sellout audience today, I think there's going to be greater use. We have another series of questions, Sabu, for you that are get quite specific, so I'm going to read them but also share them with you. These are questions from Hillary in Coralville, Iowa. And the first question is, why isn't the property owner's name entered in two fields for sorting purposes? And the second question, is the database linkable with public property records so the ownership can be kept up to date? And thirdly, is it possible to make the database viewable via the web so the public can view the information? And finally, is it possible to enter more than one permit, i.e. the NPDES permit info and a local operating permit? You might have to reiterate the question as you take on each of these. Thank you.
I guess the first question is why is name not entered like in two fields, like first name, last name? Somehow in the initial design it never came that way, but it's easily, we can actually change. So basically there are a couple of tables in the system where it's like one is personals and one is persons. And another one maybe, I think mainly that table called persons contains all the information about all the people. So if you look at the name field, if you want to split it into first name and last name, you can do it. And the second one is, the database is linkable with public property records. It is yes and no. It depends on the public record, whether it's easily accessible from outside. Like, we have done some, it's not just based on the Twist, but for a county, we have developed a tool. Actually, it covers the next question also. We developed a tool where we have the subject system database and we have an online mapping system where you have all the locations about all the systems, and then we have parcel information where we can use it to link to the public record. So, but that public record is already available like as a link for each parcel. So if your location has the same kind of settings, then you can do that. Or if you can link it through some other information directly to the database, then it's easy to do it that way too. And making it available for the web, Twist is not meant to be done that way. It's a personal database, but you can take the records and you even use the Access database, and then if you have a map component to want to link it to that Access database, you can do it. The same thing, we have done it for other counties. And the fourth question, is it possible to enter more than one permit, that is NPDES permit info and local operating permit? I think probably Barry. There are fields for separate for NPDES permit and even one, I don't remember which form, but there is a place where you can enter the NPDES number and you can probably put the local operating permit into a different, like, different field.
Yeah, and I want to stress once again that Twist was developed for EPA and distributed publicly for free use. So anyone out there is free to take Twist, adapt it, use it in whatever manner you want. It is made available for adaptation, for transmogrification into a web-based system or a system even statewide. So everyone out there should feel absolutely free to use Twist and adapt it in whatever manner best suits their purposes.
Okay, thank you. There's another question about the database. Is there any way, easy way, to import data from a source such as a spreadsheet to the Microsoft Access system? So you can take information from a spreadsheet and add it to the database. Also, with the geographic coordinates, is there a way to import them from a source such as GIS and export them as well? This is a question from Joshua in Lansing, Michigan.
Actually, it's a very good question. Right now, the Twist is, I mean, you can easily import the tables from spreadsheet, but the way Twist is designed, you have many relationships between the tables. So it's not readily usable by a simple spreadsheet, but you can customize some of, or you can develop certain tools to do it. Like we can, we know that what are the fields available, and if you can map it in the spreadsheet, then probably we can do it, but it's not like readily doable. And the second one is geographic information system. You can, of course, you can export the data, and you have the XY coordinates, that's lat longs, and you can create a shapefile. At the same time, Access cannot read the shapefiles directly. It's a proprietary or proprietary format. So the only way you can do is you can take the DBF file from or in the GIS, and then you can import it like as a DBF file, not as a shapefile.
We have another question from Gopala in, actually it doesn't say the location, it was just an email. The question is there a way that TWIST can alert you to an expired permit? And also to amplify that, if TWIST doesn't do that, is there a way, a quick fix, Sabu, that you could suggest to allow TWIST to do that for us?
Yeah, actually the answer is you need to customize the TWIST for that if you want to do it. One thing is the only thing you can enter, like you can add another field for each permit, like where you specify the expiration date, and then if you're entering that, if in the future you can add some little tools to alert that. But right now, I mean, it's easily, you can do it easily, but right now its option is not there, but you can customize, as we always say, like you can customize easily, you can add no more fields. This is basically adding one more field and adding a small tool to do it, just a simple query.
Okay, thank you. Sounds like there are a lot of possibilities to enhance the product that EPA has developed, and I'm sure many of you are already doing that. I think you possibly answered this, but just to reiterate the question that we get from Gopala also, and this is from Stone County, Missouri. Can the lat long information be used to populate a spatial database for mapping?
Yeah. Actually, I mentioned earlier this one. You can export the tables, and we are already capturing the lat longs for the site, and then you can generate easily. But if you're exporting into a DBF file, then you can easily generate a GIS layer from that. But at the same time, site, you are exporting as a single lat long XY points, but it's, sites are not generally points. You need to have the polygons to accurately represent that.
At this point, I'm going to see if we have any questions over the phone, and I'm going to ask everybody, if you're not asking a question and if you've got streaming music, to please mute yourself. We're going to try this out. Okay? So if you have a question, please unmute yourself, give your name and organization, and answer, ask the question. And we're also open to, if you want to share some of your experiences and how you've used TWIST, to briefly share if you want to amplify some of the address some of the questions that have been raised. Any questions?
Yes, this is George Beck from the Lac Vieux d'Azur tribe in Watersmeet, Michigan. Question I have is about the links. Is there some way that we would know which form links with what table?
Everybody to please mute your phones. And the gentleman that raised the question, if you can please repeat the question.
Yeah, this is George Beck from Lac Vieux d'Azur in Watersmeet, Michigan. The question was, how do we know how to link a table to a form? Which table goes with what form, that kind of thing.
If you're referring to the link table manager?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one is actually just, you just need to find the location of that backend database. all the forms and everything is automatically linked.
Oh, okay.
So
right.
You don't need to link to individual forms. It is already linked to individual tables.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. This is Cheryl in Kansas, and we're looking at trying to develop some type of system where we have the database, but then it's linked with a map. And so essentially our end product that we're hoping to have is that you can click on a point, and all of the information on that point will come up, and in this case it would be the septic system. Would this be capable to use for that type of application?
Is yes. It's basically, you need to, what you do is, if you have a point layer in your GIS which has some kind of identification which matches that in the TWIST database, then you can easily do it.
Any other questions?
Okay. I'm now muting the phones again, and we have a couple more questions that we're going to take, and then we're going to go back to our final presenter for the afternoon. One of the questions that we have is William from Shelbyville in Indiana says, I've downloaded the program, but I get a disk or a network error when trying to register. It is not read-only and is on this computer. Any suggestions?
Yeah, actually, that's a very easy solution. It's basically, what you need to do is, if you are using it directly from the CD, just copy those files into your hard drive. And if you right-click on the files, you can see the properties. If you check that there is mostly on the bottom of the screen, there is something called read-only. If that is checked, then please uncheck it and then save it. Basically, that means that you can write anything into that file. And once you have done it, then the next time when you open it, you can do the registration and all that.
And if you're still having that problem, contact us, and we'll try to walk you through that.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to take one last question and move on. The question is from Elizabeth in Franklin, Indiana. She says that we are currently logging our permits into an Access database, and she's asking, what's the purpose of changing TWIST? Is it our desire or your desire for us to use the TWIST format? I'm going to ask Joyce Hudson from our Office of Wastewater Management to address that question. Thank you.
Hello. Yes, the TWIST database was developed for the user's use. The purpose was not to supply EPA with any information. So it's really just a tool that we're providing for the public and the users to use, so there's really no way for us to access the information.
Well, I think the sense what Joyce is saying is that EPA provided this as a tool for communities to use, and there's no requirement for you to use it. If you've got a system that's working and you're able to capture the data, the information that you need in order to manage your system, I'd say keep doing it. And but if you do need a system, we just wanted to let folks know about this tool. I'm going to ask you now, we're going to end our questions. I'm going to ask you now to, at this time, to move to slide number 57. The Watershed Academy's next webcast will be on February 20th. And this webcast will highlight examples of wastewater utilities that are using watershed management approaches. So please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts, and shortly we'll have more information about this webcast on February 20th. So now please move to slide 58. We're going to move into our final section of the presentation, and I'm going to ask Steve Hoagie to take it away.
Thanks, Ann. I'd just like to spend a few minutes giving you a quick overview of some other free software tools as well as some publications that are available for small and rural community residents. Some of these products are focused on the decentralized wastewater systems, as we've been discussing today. but others deal with asset management for small centralized drinking water and wastewater systems. And I thought, since we have a broad watershed audience on the line who in many cases are from rural areas and dealing with rural issues, that centralized systems might be of interest too. On the next slide, slide 59, many of you probably recognize this publication. This is the On-Site System Design Manual. It was published in February of 2002, and it updated, it's an updated version of an earlier publication that was originally published in 1980 and actually turned out to be one of the best, I guess, most widely distributed publications that the Office of Research and Development did. And we felt it was important to capture developments in the field that have upgraded technologies and approaches since the 1980 publication came out. This is the 2002 guide is a technical guide that's intended for engineers and regulatory officials, but it's also useful for community planners and decision makers who are dealing with septic system issues. Focuses obviously on on-site system technologies and how they can be applied, what is are the most useful approaches for different local situations. And one of the ways that the manual has been updated since the 1980 manual came out is that centralized management concepts such as Barry had discussed earlier, the centralized management approach for on-site systems, it's a concept that's incorporated throughout the document, and there's a whole chapter devoted just to that particular topic. Also, another update is that a performance-based approach has been incorporated, as opposed to prescriptive standards, which historically were the norm in many areas. With a performance-based approach, it's a matter of looking at water quality objectives and how they can be met through proper design and location, taking into account the risk factors that are specific to a particular location, such as looking at the types of soils or slopes or land uses, groundwater flow rates, and those kinds of factors, rather than having a one-size-fits-all approach, which mandates separation distances or percolation rates or other kinds of rules. So that approach is represented in this handbook. Finally, another big area where it was updated is cluster systems serving more than one home are also included in the discussion in the manual. The manual reviews the latest treatment and dispersal technologies and goes into more depth in 13 of these technologies or categories of technologies in the form of fact sheets. So there's more in-depth information on each of these. And there's also a fact sheet on how to renovate existing infiltration systems. There are also fact sheets that are provided on special topics such as septic system additives or water softeners and high-strength wastes. And finally, as the discussion on technologies is presented, there's also selection approaches, how to distinguish among the technologies which ones are most appropriate for particular types of applications based on location and water quality requirements and cost and other factors. So if you're not aware of this publication, we wanted to make sure that you are aware of it. It is downloadable from the website that you see on the slide. It's in PDF format, so it's available there for your use. The next product, Joyce is pointing out that it also is available on CD, and you can go to our website, and I believe it has information there on how to order the CDs, and we'll be glad to send that out to you. Once again, this is a publication that's available free of cost. On slide 60, the next slide, Barry had mentioned the Management Handbook. This is a publication that is a follow-on to management guidelines that were voluntary guidelines that we originally promulgated back in 2003 for the management of on-site systems. And the management guidelines established kind of a conceptual framework for what we mean by various kinds of management approaches, going from less intense approaches to more intense approaches, as Barry pointed out, depending on the local situation. And the management handbook was published in 2005 as kind of a how-to or implementation sort of a guide on how a community or a local agency would approach management for their own particular situation? What are the steps that they can go through, and how do they get more information on how to develop a management program? And Barry just quickly mentioned earlier about the systematic process, or kind of a roadmap that the management handbook has, that leads a community through, you know, community outreach and education, and then going to the point of developing management goals that they want to achieve, and then what management program would be appropriate for helping them to get to that point, and then how they would implement it. And the handbook includes a number of short case studies and local examples that would illustrate each concept and each part of the process, just to make it more clear as to what we mean by the particular activities that are included in a management program, and just to give you some idea of others who have done it. There are also a lot of references in there that include websites that others have established that have a lot of in-depth information, and we also include a bibliography of terms and concepts in the management guide. The manual includes fact sheets on each of 13 management program activities or elements that we originally developed as part of the voluntary guidelines. And each of these fact sheets looks at a range of approaches for each activity. And these management activities include things like public education outreach, or site evaluation and system design, record keeping and corrective actions, funding, some of those topics of interest. So there is a fact sheet in there for each of those activities, and right now we're developing an electronic version of the handbook. As you can see on the slide, there is a PDF format version of the handbook available on the website. It's also available on CD, just as the design manual is, but we're trying to go a little bit beyond that and develop an electronic version which would have hyperlinked text within it, which would link you to various websites and other locations for more information. And one of the things that we're doing in the electronic version is for each fact sheet on each of the management topics, each of the 13 topics, we have more in-depth information to cover that particular topic, and then even more information linking you to websites and to case studies and that sort of thing. So it's our hope that we'll have this electronic version up within the next several months. So that's product. Then moving along to slide number 61, I just wanted to discuss briefly the CUFS software tool, which is a tool that's currently under development. It should be ready hopefully next spring, early in the spring, for a rollout. And once again, it's a free product that we're developing. It is software. This is the CUFS program, which stands for Checkup Program for Small Systems. We're pretty excited about this because we believe that it's going to be a very valuable tool for very small systems. We're talking about drinking water and wastewater systems that would be serving anywhere in the range of about 3,000 to 10,000 people. And the tool would allow the system managers to evaluate their system and determine what is the most efficient, lowest cost approach to maintaining the desired level of service over the long term. So the idea here is to make wise decisions, make your financial part of the operations structured in such a way that you're paying for the full cost of operating and maintaining the system, and managing the system in such a way that it will be managed at a certain level of service over the long term, indefinitely into the future. You may know that the majority of public-owned treatment works in the wastewater arena, about 70% of them are small systems. They serve less than 10,000 people. And on the drinking water side, there are over 134,000 public drinking water systems that serve less than 3,300 people. So we're talking about a huge number of facilities that are in a very small size category that are facing a lot of challenges in terms of limited staff, personnel, and other resources to be able to operate these systems. A lot of them are reaching the point in their history where there are major components of the system, especially buried assets such as distribution systems or wastewater collection systems, as well as the treatment systems and storage tanks and other components that were constructed some time ago, and they're reaching the end of their useful life, and there's going to be a need for rehabilitation or replacement. In many cases, the original capital investments were really made with the assistance of outside funding sources such as grants or other funding. In many cases, developers help to fund extension of collection systems and that sort of thing. Now the utilities are faced with some major expenses that they're going to have to deal with on their own with very limited outside assistance. And in some cases, since we're talking about rural communities in some parts of the country, we're talking about a shrinking revenue base because some of these communities are losing population. So decisions become even more critical, and it's more essential to be cost-effective in how you approach replacement and repair decisions. So CUPS is a tool that would provide these kinds of utilities with the opportunity to be more informed in their decision-making, and it's a great communication tool to be able to have the manager, for example, who's familiar with the system and knows the ins and outs of the various components and knows what kinds of parts are in need of repair and how much it'll cost. It allows him to be able to communicate with the decision-makers, in many cases appointed or elected board members who may not be that familiar with their system. And this is a good tool for being able to come out with some reports and graphs and things that visually and very succinctly give some idea of why certain decisions need to be made about funding and perhaps raising user rates and things like that. So next slide, slide 62, reviews five basic questions that this software is intended to answer. The first one is, for a system, what assets do they own, such as pumps or pipes or buildings or tanks or other components, and what is the current condition of each asset? How much useful life remains? What's the cost of maintaining each asset versus repairing or replacing it? That kind of information for each asset. Now, the program is set up so that you don't have to enter every asset in your system in order to have the program be functional. So even if you have only four or five assets entered, then the program can already be used. The second question is, what level of service is required? And this is something that would be specific to each community for their own system and would include such factors as how many outages are acceptable or how many overflows per year, how many customer complaints would they find acceptable, what is the level of compliance violations with regulatory requirements and things like that. This level of service would establish the goals or kind of the benchmark against which you can measure future success. The third question is, what assets are critical? And this allows for the evaluation of each asset in terms of what are the consequences if that asset fails to function. Is it going to knock out the whole system, or is there a redundancy built into the system that would allow those impacts to be mitigated? The fourth question is, what is the best capital approach and O&M approach? Because all the information that would be entered into the software would allow for decision making regarding what maintenance or replacement needs should be addressed, and it actually produces a risk matrix that helps in that kind of decision making. So that way the utility can identify what are the most cost-effective investments and what is the timing of those investments. And then all that is organized in kind of a wizard sort of a format to produce a capital improvement plan for the utility. The final question here is, what's the best long-term funding strategy? And CUPS does allow for a long-term financial analysis for operating the system, and it highlights issues such as, is the system collecting adequate revenues currently, and what kind of capital improvement projects need to be undertaken, and what is the timing of those improvements. The next slide, slide 63, shows you the user interface with the system, and we are very aware of how for these small systems there is just a very limited amount of time and resources that the system managers have available. So we really tried to design the system to be just very simple, straightforward. We tried to make the interface very user-friendly. And so we've tried to allow a good bit of analysis with minimum effort and minimum confusion. So we've tried to keep everything simple and intuitive. And as you can see on the screen, there are a number of modules that are the whole software is organized around various modules, and each module performs a particular function. So, for example, the user might want to do some financial analysis, so he clicks on that module, or he may want to do more asset inventory, add more assets to the inventory, or edit the information that he's already put in there. And as he clicks on one of these icons for a particular module, then he's prompted by the system as to what kind of information he needs to add. And, you know, very similar to the Twist model or the Twist software, there are a number of drop-down screens and things like that where you can pick information, or in some cases you can just enter your own system-specific information that you can add in there. Also throughout the program, there's going to be help that's available within the context of where you are in the software. So it's specific to the steps that you're trying to accomplish. And there are various wizards that allow you to develop financial reports as well as asset inventory reports. We also hope to include some examples of the kind of data that would be entered for each particular step. The, as you can see on the right-hand side of that screen, there's a calendar feature that's included, and that highlights what kinds of maintenance activities need to be done on particular days, and it also flags which maintenance items and particular work items are past due. And as I mentioned earlier, the program develops based on the information that the user inputs on the particular assets and their condition. It comes up with a risk matrix that's based on probability of failure versus the criticality of each asset to the system. And so it ranks each of the assets on that matrix, and it really highlights, you know, which assets are in need of attention first. So as I mentioned, the program is currently in development. We hope to have a beta version available within about 2 months. And we'll be testing it with about 10 or 15 small systems throughout the country, both water and wastewater systems. And we'll be having a final release next spring. We're working pretty closely with RCAP and other service providers who work with small communities to get them familiar with the program, train them, and get information out. And then we'll have a pretty broad kind of a marketing strategy that'll provide a lot of outreach, so hopefully you'll be hearing about the software as it comes out in the spring. Just very briefly, just wanted to make you aware of a couple of other products. These were both developed by others with funding assistance from EPA, and they're useful in the area of either developing and building a wastewater system or managing the system that you already have. The first product is TEAMS, which stands for Total Electronic Asset Management System. And this is, once again, an asset management tool. It's for wastewater systems from systems serving about 10,000 population or less. And it's very similar to the CUPS software in that it has the same concepts built into it. The difference is that it is more robust. It's more detailed. CUPS is going to be based on another type of software that cannot be modified, whereas Teams is based on Microsoft Access, so it's open source software. It can be modified and tailored for a particular system. And as I said, it does have more robust features than CUPS. It would allow for a lot more detail on things like scheduling day-to-day tasks for maintenance, doing more detailed valuation of assets, doing more in-depth cost analyses, and that sort of thing. This is available, as you can see, on the website that's maintained by the Maryland Center for Environmental Training, who developed the TEAMS software. And it includes a user guide as well as training materials. So, once again, this is free software. I believe you order a CD from MSET, and then they will send it out to you free of cost. And finally, the last tool that I wanted to mention is called WATAR, which stands for Water and Wastewater Treatment Technologies Appropriate for Reuse. This is a tool that was developed by Humboldt State University, and it's a technical tool that's targeted really for engineers and planners who are familiar with the wastewater treatment process, because it does get into technical details in terms of the various steps in the treatment train and that sort of thing. But it's a very useful planning tool. It's kind of a screening tool that would be applied before you do a more in-depth feasibility study of wastewater options. So what it allows you to do is to look at a range of technologies. I think it has like over 200 technologies in it. And based on your local needs and your local objectives in terms of, you know, water quality requirements that you need to meet, or what's acceptable to the public or not, or local site constraints and things like that, you can go through a step-by-step process and evaluate what technologies might be most appropriate for your situation, and it costs out those technologies and indicates what kinds of features are favorable and that sort of thing. The tool has been, it was actually developed for use in the Middle East and has been used in Eastern Europe and in developing countries where various agencies such as USAID were looking at wastewater options for rural and small community-type areas. But it's certainly applicable to U.S. communities and has been used in some U.S. communities as well. So I'll stop right there. The next slide, slide 65, has information on me, how you can contact me. So certainly feel free to follow up if you have any questions about any of these tools, and I'll be glad to give you more information. And I'll turn it over to Ann for further discussion here.
Thank you, Steve. You can also move now to slide 66. We are going to open session up. Remaining session for questions with all three of our speakers. But first I want to draw your attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you're participating by streaming audio online, please click on the home button at the top of your screen and you'll be returned to the seminar's home page, which has the speaker's email addresses and phone numbers. So I know there were a number of questions about TWIST. Maybe you can follow up on that among other items. Moving to slide 67, again, for those that are participating online, please take a look at the left-hand sidebar. There's a links button which has additional resources identified for today's webcast, and we have the URL on slide 67 here. So please avail yourself of those resources. Also, on the left-hand sidebar is a feedback button, and we'd appreciate if you take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do consider your comments in our quest to improve our webcasts. And there's the URL for those that do not are participating online. We will now address some of the questions that have been submitted online. The first question, I think, is really directed at EPA. And the question from Morris in Chicago, Illinois, is, could EPA or possibly another organization, possibly a group that's participating on this call, could they host a forum or some sort of topic section in an existing forum, possibly using the decentralized list server, for people that are using TWIST and post questions and offer answers about how TWIST can be adapted and has been adapted by the users? The questioner also says, further, since this is a flexible database, maybe this discussion could lead to or spawn modified and expanded TWIST versions, which may be even better than the version that EPA has provided to date.
This is Joyce Hudson and with EPA, and I'll answer this question. It's a good question. I think what we'd like to do is to first determine what the level of interest is for some sort of forum or, you know, another perhaps webcast or maybe other venue for answering questions from those people who are actually using TWIST or would like to use it. We do have a listserv, decentralized listserv on our main website, and I think maybe the best way to approach this is to submit your interest either, you know, to us or to or through the website, which we do monitor, and we can then determine, you know, what the level of interest is for some type of forum or activity to address this. And then the second half of that is question is whether we could spawn modified or expanded versions of TWIST that might be more useful. I guess the answer there is that we are not anticipating EPA revising or expanding TWIST at this point, unless we get, you know, overwhelming interest in its use. I think, you know, as many other speakers before have already indicated, there's the ability for the users to modify and expand Twist as they see fit. But again, if we do see, you know, the level of interest that warrants something like this, we would certainly consider it.
Thank you very much, Joyce. Excellent question, and hopefully we'll follow up in some way to address that interest. Steve, there's a question here that's for you about, or it's the question is about CUPS, this checkup program for small systems. And the question is CUPS developed in Microsoft Access?
The short answer is no. And actually, it's currently being developed, and I don't know. I think somebody said it was Cold Fusion or something. I'm really not that familiar with the technical aspect of it. It is a standalone software, so it's not web-based. It will be produced on a CD, which will be provided to the users. So it is definitely not a Microsoft Access program.
Okay, and one more question about Twist to round out our discussion. The question is from Ray in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Where do you enter permit effluent requirements and analytical sample data? The question is, and maybe it's okay if we can't answer it, but where do you enter permit effluent requirements and analytical sample data?
Currently, there is, I don't remember any field to enter that, but you probably need to customize it to add more fields, and then you can do that.
At this time, please, I'm going to ask you to mute your phone if you haven't done so, and I'm going to ask you questions over the phone. Please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before you ask a question. Any questions, please? Questions? It looks like there are no further questions. At this time, this is going to conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the, I have one last comment from Barry Towning about Twist or whatever.
As Sabu said, that you can add some data fields and customize Twist to add that. If you look back on slide number 38, you do see the operating permit information. There's also, I think, an NPDES permit number on another one of those tabs on top. If you click through those tabs on top of that permit information group of data, you will see on slide 38, if you click on operating permit, you see some inspection information there, inspection frequency type, and on down on the right-hand side there, effluent sample, I think that's the yes-no drop-down box, effluent sampling frequency type, groundwater sample and so forth. So this is where you would add that kind of information. You know, there are a few data fields there that you can start to use, but it does not have right now the effluent requirements, but they can easily be added.
Okay. Thank you. I think we are done now, and so I want to thank everybody for hanging in there on this. This concludes today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Barry Towning, Sabu Paul, and Steve Hoagie for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Ann Weinberg from EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day.